You know that feeling, right? That primal, gut-wrenching moment, that sudden struggle just to pull air into your lungs when every single breath feels like this desperate fight. It's truly one of the most frightening things anyone can go through. And that's exactly why today we're taking a really close look at a topic that is, well, literally vital: respiratory emergencies. Our mission here is basically to give you a shortcut, a way to understand this critical area, maybe turn some of that fear into informed awareness.
Exactly. And we've really dug into a whole stack of pre-hospital emergency care guidelines, pulled out the most important stuff for you. Our goal really is to equip you with the knowledge so you can recognize the key signs when someone's in trouble and grasp the underlying causes, for different conditions and understand the immediate care strategies that can make such a huge difference, whether you're looking at an adult or a child or an older person.
Yeah, so we're going to explore how our breathing actually works, what happens when it goes wrong, obviously, and what those kind of alarming sounds coming from the lungs really mean. Then we'll get into specific conditions like emphysema and asthma, unpack their unique challenges, and look at the critical tools and techniques used in real emergencies. And this is where it gets really interesting, I think, how care needs to be carefully tailored for kids, for the elderly. They show such different signs. So, okay, let's unpack this.
Let's do it. Starting with the basics, I guess. Our respiratory system is, well, it's an intricate marvel, isn't it? Designed for one absolutely crucial job: swapping oxygen for carbon dioxide. You've got the upper airway, that's your nose, your throat, then the lower airway, your windpipe, bronchial tubes, and finally the lungs themselves, holding millions of these tiny air sacs, the alveoli. And normal breathing, it's way more than just a regular rhythm. It's about that seamless, totally effortless swap of gases happening deep inside, keeping you perfectly oxygenated.
And what's fascinating, like you said, is how easily this whole perfectly balanced system can just be thrown off kilter. It really doesn't take much for that easy, normal breathing to shift into a life-threatening struggle. So when we talk about abnormal breathing, what's usually the root cause? What's going wrong at that basic level?
Well, often it really boils down to impairing that gas exchange. So picture those alveoli, the tiny air sacs, and the pulmonary capillaries, those microscopic blood vessels wrapped around them. That's where the swap happens, right? Oxygen for CO2. Problems pop up if there's, say, increased space between them, makes the journey for oxygen much harder. Or maybe there's just not enough blood flow, what we call perfusion, getting to those capillaries. Or even simpler, sometimes those alveoli just get clogged with fluid or blood or even pus, directly blocking that vital exchange. It's like trying to breathe through a wet sponge, basically.
Okay, that makes sense. So if we can't actually see what's going on inside, how do first responders, get those crucial clues?
One of the most telling ways is simply by listening to the lungs with the stethoscope. You listen directly over bare skin in really specific key spots, like just below the collarbones in the front, under the armpits on the sides, and below the shoulder blades in the back. These locations give us the best sort of window into what the lungs are doing.
Right. And when you listen, you're not just checking if air is moving, you're listening for specific sounds, aren't you? What are they and what story do they tell?
Exactly. You're hunting for abnormal sounds that paint a picture, like a high-pitched whistling sound, almost like air squeezing through a super narrow tube. That's wheezing, often signals narrowed airways, like in asthma. Then there's a low-pitched rumbling sound, raunchy, that can mean there's mucus or junk in the larger airways, kind of like a gurgle. And then you have crackles. Those are fine, crackling, almost like Velcro sounds. Often means fluid down in the smaller air sacs, the alveoli. Each sound is really a vital piece of the puzzle. It helps point us towards the actual problem.
Okay, this brings us to a really critical point, and honestly a scary one: defining inadequate breathing. When someone isn't breathing effectively, their body is facing this terrifying double threat, isn't it?
That's absolutely right. The first is hypoxemia, which is simply too little oxygen getting into the blood. We often see this when the oxygen saturation, this SpO2, drops below 94%. And the second threat is hypercarbia. That means too much carbon dioxide building up in the blood. If you don't treat it, this inadequate breathing can escalate really fast to cardiovascular failure and, well, tragically, sometimes death.
So we're talking about a spectrum then. It's not just breathing or not breathing, there are levels of trouble. How do you categorize these disturbances?
Yeah, we generally group them into three main categories to help guide treatment. First up is respiratory distress. Okay, here, The patient's breathing rate might be okay, and the amount of air they're moving with each breath, that's the tidal volume, it's adequate. But they're working really hard to compensate. You can see they're struggling. Treatment here focuses on giving oxygen, trying to keep their SpO2 at 94% or higher. And sometimes we consider using CPAP continuous positive airway pressure to help keep those airways open.
Okay, stress is step one. What's next?
Next is respiratory failure. Now, this is more critical. Either the breathing rate or the tidal volume, or maybe both, become inadequate. They just aren't moving enough air effectively. This patient needs help immediately, often with assisted ventilations, using a bag valve mask, plus supplemental oxygen. They're at a really high risk of deteriorating, maybe even going into arrest. And finally, the most severe is respiratory arrest. This is the complete stop, no breathing effort at all. This will lead to cardiac arrest within just minutes if you don't intervene. So immediate bag valve mask ventilations with high flow oxygen is absolutely vital, life-saving.
Wow, okay. So from the outside, looking at someone, what are those common signs? What makes you think, okay, this person is in respiratory distress?
Well, the most obvious is they'll likely complain of shortness of breath. That feeling of not getting enough air, we call it dyspnea. They might seem restless, agitated, maybe even confused. That's often a sign the brain isn't getting enough oxygen. You'll probably notice changes in their pulse rate could be fast, could be slow later on. Changes in their breathing rate and depth, are they breathing fast and shallow, or slow and deep? And critically, look at their skin color. Is it pale? Or worse, developing a bluish tint, especially around the lips or nail beds. That's cyanosis, a late sign of low oxygen.
And these signals, they could point to so many different underlying problems, could they?
Right.
Narrowed air tubes, like in asthma or bronchitis, physical injuries to the chest, heart problems causing fluid backup, even mechanical issues like a collapsed lung. So for the person actually experiencing it, what does all this mean in that moment?
It means every single second counts. A rapid assessment, figuring out the potential underlying cause, it's paramount. You're kind of like a detective, really, piecing together all these clues, the sounds, the appearance, the history under immense pressure.
Right. Let's try and put a face to some of these challenges. Imagine we encounter, say, 62-year-old Margaret Brown. We find her sitting at her kitchen table. She's leaning forward, resting her hands on her knees to breathe that classic tripod position. She looks thin. And her chest seems unusually rounded, almost barrel-shaped. You can actually see her using her neck and shoulder muscles just to help pull air in. And she's doing this thing where she purses her lips as she breathes out carefully. Nearby, there's an oxygen concentrator humming away and a nebulizer machine on the table. Just seeing that scene, you immediately think, okay, Margaret is likely dealing with some pretty significant chronic respiratory issues. And that leads us right into a group of conditions many people have heard of, but maybe don't fully grasp the differences. Chronic obstructive pulmonary diseases, or COPD. Experts, one of the big players here, emphysema and chronic bronchitis, right? How do they actually differ?
Exactly. Those are the two main types, emphysema and chronic bronchitis. And while they both fall under the COPD umbrella, meaning they obstruct airflow, they impact the lungs quite differently. With emphysema, the actual structure of the lungs changes. The delicate lung tissue loses its springiness, its elasticity. And worse, the walls of those tiny air sacs, the alveoli, they get destroyed over time. This directly sabotages the gas exchange process. And actually, a surprising fact, that pursed lip breathing you mentioned with Margaret, patients with emphysema often do that instinctively. They're essentially creating their own back pressure, like a natural form of PEEP positive and expiratory pressure to help keep the smaller airways from collapsing when they exhale. It's their body's clever, if desperate, improvisation. Margaret's barrel chest and that pursed lip breathing are really classic signs of emphysema. They usually complain of shortness of breath, especially when they exert themselves.
Wow, their own PEEP. That's fascinating. Okay, so how is chronic bronchitis different then?
Right, so chronic bronchitis is more about the airways, the tubes themselves. Here, the lining of the bronchi and the smaller bronchioles becomes inflamed, swollen, and thickened, and they produce a lot more mucus. Crucially, though, the alveoli themselves, the air sacs, usually remain largely unaffected, unlike in emphysema. This condition is very strongly linked to smoking. It typically causes a persistent cough that brings up phlegm, a productive cough. Because the air tubes are narrowed and clogged, airflow is reduced. This leads to less ventilation getting to parts of the lung. Patients often have that bluish tint to their skin, the cyanosis, because of the poor oxygenation. And in severe cases, you might even see something called asterixis, a kind of flapping tremor of the wrists when they hold them out, which is linked to high CO2 levels.
Okay, so different mechanisms, same result,
yeah.
Difficulty breathing. For emergency care with COPD patients, what's the really key guideline we need to remember?
Well, the general guidelines for difficulty breathing apply, obviously, oxygen, monitoring. But there's a really crucial nuance, especially for some COPD patients. Some develop what's known as a hypoxic drive. Basically, their body gets used to high CO2 levels and instead relies on low oxygen levels as the main trigger to breathe. It's flipped from normal. So for these specific individuals, we don't want to just blast them with high flow oxygen aiming for 100% saturation. Instead, the recommendation is often to maintain their oxygen saturation, their SpO2, in a target range, typically between 88% and 92%. Pushing it much higher might actually, paradoxically, reduce their drive to breathe. CPAP can also be very helpful for COPD exacerbations, but always with careful monitoring.
That 88-92% target is a really important detail. Okay, let's pivot from those chronic conditions to one that can strike much more suddenly and is incredibly common, especially in younger people. Asthma. What's physically happening inside the airways during an asthma attack?
Asthma is essentially an oversensitivity or hyperreactivity of the lower airways. When someone with asthma encounters a trigger, it could be pollen, dust, smoke, exercise, stress, and infection, their airways react excessively. And it's a triple whammy inside those smaller air tubes, the bronchioles. First, you get bronchospasm. The smooth muscles surrounding the airways clamp down, tighten up. Second, there's edema. The lining of the airway swells up. And third, the airways produce way more mucus than usual, which further clogs things up. All three combine to dramatically narrow the airways, making it incredibly difficult to breathe, especially breathing out.
That sounds awful. And what's fascinating here, you mentioned earlier, is that not all asthma attacks are the same speed. There are different types.
Yeah, absolutely. And this distinction is really important clinically. We generally see two patterns, slow onset and rapid onset asthma. About 80%, the vast majority, are slow onset. Here, the symptoms get worse gradually over maybe 6 hours or even several days. These tend to be more common in females, and often they're triggered by an upper respiratory infection like a cold. But then there's rapid onset asthma. This accounts for about 20% of cases. Here, the deterioration happens fast, in less than 6 hours. These are more common in males and often triggered by things like allergens, exercise, or sudden stress. And here's the critical point. Mm-hmm. Rapid onset asthma is far more likely to result in death. So as emergency providers, when we suspect rapid onset, we have to be hypervigilant and prepared for the patient to potentially progress quickly to respiratory failure or even arrest.
Wow, that rapid onset distinction is a really powerful insight. Knowing that changes the urgency level immediately. So for asthma emergencies, what are the main go-to interventions?
Okay, first, supplemental oxygen is key, aiming to keep that SpO2 at 94% or higher. CPAP can also be beneficial, helping to stent open those narrowed airways. And critically, we use medications called beta-2 agonists, things like albuterol, often given via an inhaler or nebulizer. These drugs specifically target and relax those tightened, smooth muscles around the bronchioles, helping the airways open back up. They are the cornerstone of acute asthma treatment. Oh, and one more thing, if we do need to assist their breathing with a bag valve mask, it's crucial to allow plenty of time for them to exhale fully between breaths. Asthmatic airways tend to trap air, so forcing air in without letting it out properly can actually make things worse. Slow, controlled ventilation is key.
Makes sense. Okay, beyond COPD and asthma, the respiratory system is, well, vulnerable to a whole host of other issues, each with its own kind of signature. We probably can't deep dive into every single one, but maybe we can quickly touch on a few more critical scenarios, focusing on the unique tells, the things that make you suspect that particular condition.
Sure. Let's hit a few key ones. First, maybe pulmonary embolism, or PE. This is a blockage, usually a blood clot that's traveled from elsewhere, off to the legs, lodging in the arteries that feed the lungs. It frequently happens after someone's been immobile for a while, like after surgery or long flight. The critical insight, the tell for PE, is often its presentation. A sudden onset of unexplained shortness of breath, maybe some sharp chest pain, signs of low oxygen. But when you listen to their lungs, the breath sounds might be surprisingly clear and normal. The lungs might be moving air okay, but the blood flow is blocked, so gas exchange fails. That mismatch is a big clue.
Sudden onset, clear lungs, but hypoxic. Got it. What else?
Okay, how about acute pulmonary edema, or APE? This is where fluid backs up from the heart, often due to cardiac dysfunction like heart failure, and floods the space between the alveoli and the capillaries. It literally drowns the lungs from the inside. The typical tell here is hearing crackles when you listen to the lungs, especially at the bases. That fluid makes a noise. Now, there's a more dramatic, severe form called sympathetic crashing acute pulmonary edema, or SCAPE. This is a really sudden, extreme flash pulmonary edema. It's triggered by a massive surge from the sympathetic nervous system, the fight or flight system, causing widespread vasoconstriction, clamping down blood vessels everywhere. This forces fluid into the lungs incredibly rapidly. SCAPE is a true emergency, requires immediate CPAP and often nitroglycerin to help relax those constricted blood vessels. It's a very different beast than typical APE.
SCAPE, wow, sounds intense. One more maybe.
Yeah.
Something non-cardiac.
All right, let's do spontaneous pneumothorax. This is when a lung collapses suddenly, but without any trauma, like a stabbing or car crash. It happens when the visceral lining, the thin membrane covering the lung surface, ruptures, letting air leak out into the chest cavity, collapsing the lung. It's more common in tall, thin young men, smokers, or people with underlying lung conditions like COPD or connective tissue disorders. The key assessment findings here are sudden onset of shortness of breath, often sharp pain on one side, and crucially, decreased or absent breath sounds when you listen to that affected side of the chest, especially near the top, the apex. And here's a vital insight, major don't. CPAP is absolutely contraindicated in spontaneous pneumothorax. Why? Because forcing positive pressure air in the thorax can actually make the air leak worse and increase the lung collapse. Big danger zone there.
Okay, wow. So many different causes, and like you said, each with its own clues and specific treatments or even contraindications, like with CPAP and pneumothorax. This really raises the important question, what are the key interventions we actually have in our toolkit? How do we help?
Yeah, that's the critical next step, isn't it? Moving from assessment to action, let's talk about some of the most common and powerful interventions we use.
Right. We mentioned Margaret Brown earlier and how she likely uses a metered dose inhaler, an MDI. These devices, along with small volume nebulizers, or SVNs, are designed specifically to deliver those beta-2 specific bronchodilators we talked about. Medications like albuterol or ipratropium, these are the drugs that work directly on the smooth muscles wrapped around the bronchial tubes, telling them to relax, helping those constricted airways open wide again.
Exactly. And when we're thinking about helping a patient use their MDI or administering a nebulizer treatment, there are clear guidelines, sort of a checklist. First, the patient must actually be in respiratory distress. Second, they need to have a physician-prescribed medication specifically for this kind of breathing problem. And third, depending on local protocols, you usually need approval from medical direction, either online or via standing orders. Now, on the flip side, the contraindications. If the patient is unresponsive and can't inhale it themselves, obviously you can't use an MDI. If it's not their prescribed medication, if you don't have medical direction approval, or if they've already taken the maximum allowed dose before you arrived, then it's a no-go.
Right. Makes sense. And it's important for people to know about potential side effects too, isn't it? Even with prescribed meds.
Definitely. While these drugs are generally safe when used correctly, they can cause some side effects. Most commonly, patients might feel their heart racing a bit, tachycardia. They might get tremors or feel shaky, maybe a bit nervous or anxious. A dry mouth is common too, and occasionally some nausea or vomiting. Usually mild, but good to be aware of. Oh, and here's a really critical insight, especially for asthma patients. Many use combination inhalers like Advair or Symbicort daily. These contain a long-acting bronchodilator and a steroid. They are maintenance drugs designed to prevent attacks over the long term. They should never be used as a rescue inhaler during an acute sudden asthma attack. They work too slowly and aren't designed for immediate relief. That's what the short-acting beta-2 agonists like albuterol are for. Big difference.
That's a super important distinction. Okay, so if it is appropriate to help someone with their MDI, how do you actually do it correctly?
Right. Proper technique is vital to get the medicine where it needs to go deep into the lungs. First, always confirm it's appropriate. Check the rights of medication administration. Right patient, right drug, right dose, right route, right time, right documentation. Check the expiration date. Then you need to shake the inhaler vigorously for at least 30 seconds. This mixes the propellant and the medication properly. If the inhaler hasn't been used recently or it's brand new, you should prime it by spraying one or two puffs into the air away from anyone. Then instruct the patient. Ideally, they should exhale fully first. Then, as they start to breathe in slowly and deeply through their mouth over about 5 seconds, you, or they, depress the canister fully, just once. They need to try and hold their breath for about 10 seconds, or as long as they comfortably can. This lets the medication settle deep in the airways. Then they should exhale slowly, preferably through pursed lips. After the dose, you wait a minute or two as per protocol, and then reassess their breathing, their heart rate, their overall condition. And if they have one, using a valved holding chamber or spacer is highly recommended. It attaches to the MDI, holds the medication cloud, and makes it much easier to coordinate the breath and get more medicine into the lungs, especially for kids or adults who find the timing tricky.
Good rundown. Shaking, priming, slow inhale, hold, slow exhale. And the spacer helps a lot. Okay, what about CPAP? You mentioned it earlier.
Yes, continuous positive airway pressure, or CPAP. This is a non-invasive way to support breathing. The device, usually a mask over the nose or nose and mouth, delivers a constant stream of pressurized air. This positive pressure helps to physically hold the airways and alveoli open, especially during exhalation when they tend to collapse in conditions like COPD or pulmonary edema. It can be incredibly beneficial for many forms of respiratory distress, reducing the work of breathing and improving oxygenation. When it's working well, we look for signs of improvement. The patient reports feeling less short of breath, their oxygen saturation, SpO2 goes up, their breathing effort looks more normal, less accessory muscle use, slower rate, and they often become more alert as their oxygen levels improve.
Okay, so it can be a game changer, but it's not without risks, right? You have to watch closely.
Absolutely. CPAP requires constant monitoring. It's crucial to watch for signs of deterioration. This could include their breathing rate actually increasing despite the CPAP, maybe they're becoming more lethargic or exhausted from fighting the pressure, or they lose the ability to speak in full sentences. Or, critically, if their SpO2 starts decreasing despite the CPAP, these are signs it's not working, or the underlying condition is worsening, and we might need to consider more invasive measures like intubation. And let's circle back one more time to that vital contraindication we discussed. CPAP is absolutely not appropriate for a patient with a suspected spontaneous pneumothorax. Putting positive pressure into a chest with a leaking lung can be disastrous. So careful assessment first is key.
Got it. Monitor closely, look for improvement, watch for deterioration, and remember that pneumothorax contraindication. Okay, now let's talk about those age-related variations, because this is huge. A child struggling to breathe or an older adult, it really is a completely different picture, isn't it? Let's imagine 5-year-old Sarah Gross. She has a known history of asthma, and suddenly she's having significant trouble breathing at her daycare center. What immediately needs to be top of mind for Sarah?
This is such a critical area. Children are not just small adults. Their anatomy, smaller airways, bigger tongue relative to mouth size, softer chest wall, and their physiology are very different. And here's arguably the single most important insight for pediatrics. Respiratory failure is the leading cause of both respiratory arrest and cardiac arrest in children. Unlike adults, where cardiac arrest is often primary, in kids, breathing problems usually come first. So recognizing the signs early is paramount. Early signs of respiratory distress in a child often involve just an increased breathing rate, tachypnea, and increased effort. You might see their nostrils flaring, maybe some mild retractions where the skin pulls in between the ribs or above the collarbone. As they worsen and move towards decompensated failure, those retractions become much more prominent. You'll see them using their neck muscles, the muscles between their ribs, intercostal muscles, even their abdominal muscles, just desperately trying to pull air in. They might make grunting sounds. Respiratory arrest in children is almost always preceded by this kind of progressive failure. Spotting it early and intervening aggressively is key to preventing arrest.
That progression is terrifying. Are there specific conditions we see more often in kids?
Yes, definitely. Besides asthma, there are a few classic pediatric respiratory emergencies. One is croup. This is usually a viral infection of the upper airway below the vocal cords. It causes swelling there, leading to a very distinctive seal bark cough and inspiratory stridor, that high-pitched noise when they breathe in, indicating a narrow airway. It often sounds worse at night. Interestingly, sometimes just taking the child out into cool night air can help reduce the swelling a bit. Then there's epiglottitis. This is much less common now thanks to vaccines, but far more dangerous. It's a bacterial infection causing rapid, severe swelling of the epiglottis, that little flap at the back of the throat. It has a sudden onset, usually with a high fever, severe sore throat, difficulty swallowing leading to drooling, and that muffled voice. They often sit bolt upright in a tripod position, looking scared and toxic. Inspiratory stridor is a very ominous sign here, and here is that crucial warning again. Never, ever try to look in the mouth or place anything in the mouth of a child suspected of having epiglottitis. You could trigger complete airway obstruction. Keep them calm, give oxygen if tolerated, and transport immediately. And one more common one is bronchiolitis. This is inflammation of the tiniest airways, the bronchioles, usually caused by a virus, most often RSV, respiratory syncytial virus. It mainly affects infants and young children. Symptoms often look a lot like asthma, wheezing, rapid breathing, cough, but it's caused by inflammation, not bronchospasm primarily.
Okay, so croup, epiglottitis, bronchiolitis, distinct pediatric challenges. And the overarching theme is that kids can crash fast. What about the other end of the age spectrum, our geriatric patients?
The elderly also present really unique challenges. Their baseline respiratory function might already be diminished due to aging or chronic conditions. And like kids, they can progress from distress to failure quite rapidly, sometimes with fewer obvious warning signs. Here's a key insight for geriatrics. They might not exhibit the typical responses to hypoxia, low oxygen, or hypercapnia, high carbon dioxide. Their body's signaling might be blunted. They also might not develop a fever even if they have a severe infection like pneumonia. Their temperature regulation can be off. This lack of classic signs can make early recognition tricky, which is why a high index of suspicion is vital. Common causes of shortness of breath or dyspnea in the elderly include things we've discussed like pulmonary edema, often related to heart failure, pulmonary embolism, COPD exacerbations, but also pneumonia is very common, especially aspiration pneumonia, where they accidentally inhale food, liquid, or stomach contents into their lungs due to swallowing difficulties or reduced consciousness.
No fever, blunted response to low O2. That makes assessment much harder. These age-specific differences, wow, they really hammer home the importance of that tailored assessment, don't they? What stands out to you is the universal principle cutting across all these ages and conditions.
Yeah. Despite the differences, the core principle remains the same. It's the systematic assessment-based approach. That's universal. For every single patient, regardless of age, you start with your scene size up. Is it safe? What might have happened? Then your primary assessment, forming a general impression, checking mental status, alert, verbal, pain, unresponsive ABPU scale, assessing the airway, is it open, breathing, rate, quality, effort, sounds, and circulation, pulse, skin color, temperature, condition. Identify and manage life threats immediately. Then if the patient is stable enough, you move to a secondary assessment, getting a history using tools like OPQRST for pain or shortness of breath, onset, provocation, quality, radiation region, severity, time, asking about allergies, medications, past history, last oral intake, events leading up, sample history, performing a relevant physical exam, definitely including listening carefully to lung sounds in all fields, and getting a full set of vital signs, pulse, respiration, blood pressure, septo2, maybe temperature.
Right. And remembering those subtle clues, especially changes in mental status, restlessness, agitation, confusion, these can be early, crucial signs that the brain isn't getting enough oxygen, even before the pulse ox drops or they turn blue. Always look at the chest. Is it rising and falling equally? How much effort is involved? Listen and feel for air movement at the mouth and nose. And auscultate those lungs thoroughly. And the basic algorithm holds true. If breathing is inadequate, too slow, too shallow, absent hypoxic, then positive pressure ventilation is your immediate top priority. If breathing seems adequate in terms of rate and volume, but they're struggling or hypoxic, then administer supplemental oxygen to get that SpO2 up. And remember, any patient with significant difficulty breathing is always considered a priority. Needs prompt assessment, intervention, and usually rapid transport to the hospital.
Absolutely. And one last crucial piece, reassessment. It's not a one and done thing. You have to constantly reevaluate your patient, especially if their condition is serious or you've intervened. Are they getting better? Worse? Staying the same. Keep checking their mental status, their airway patency, their respiratory rate and effort, their oxygen saturation, their heart rate and skin color. How are they responding to your treatments? It's worth noting again, like we said with MDIs, some interventions like bronchodilators can cause a slight expected increase in heart rate. That doesn't necessarily mean they're getting worse. It's a known side effect. But you need to look at the whole picture. Are they breathing easier? Is their oxygen level improving? Reassessment guides your next steps.
We've really covered a huge amount of ground today, haven't we? It feels like a proper deep dive. We've looked across the whole spectrum of respiratory emergencies, from those first maybe subtle signs of distress, all the way to the life-threatening urgency of complete respiratory arrest. We've seen how common underlying conditions like COPD and asthma actually work inside the body, how they manifest. And we really uncovered some critical differences in how these emergencies play out in children versus the elderly, underscoring that absolute need for assessment and care tailored to the specific patient.
Yeah, it's a lot, but it's so important. And I think the key takeaway is that while the causes of respiratory distress are incredibly varied, infections, chronic diseases, clots, collapses, allergies, trauma, the common thread weaving through all of them is that critical need for prompt recognition and the right intervention at the right time. Whether that intervention is simply giving supplemental oxygen or actively assisting their ventilations with a bag valve mask or administering specific medications like bronchodilators or applying CPAP, understanding how our body breathes, how it signals trouble, and how it reacts to these different threats is just incredibly empowering knowledge. It allows us potentially to move from just being a bystander witnessing distress to being someone who can effectively intervene and make a difference.
So well put. Empowering is the right word. Okay, here's a final thought for you, our listener, something to maybe mull over after we finish. Next time you happen to hear someone struggling to breathe, maybe in public, maybe someone you know, or you just see someone exhibiting those signs we talked about, think about the details we discussed today, the position they might adopt, like that tripod stance, the sounds they might be making, wheezing, crackles, their age, any clues about their medical history. These aren't just abstract medical observations anymore, are they? They are urgent, real-time clues. So the question to ponder is, how might this deep dive we've taken today change how you observe the world around you? How might it empower you specifically to recognize those subtle or not so subtle signals that could be the very first step in making a potentially life-saving difference for someone?